This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your working Corbin Blue of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
I am not a stranger to the dark. Hide away, they say, because we don't want your broken parts. I've learned to be ashamed of all my scars. Run away, they say, no one will love you as you are. But I won't let them break me down to dust. I know that there's a place for us, for we are glorious. When the sharpest words wanna cut me down, gonna send a blood, gonna drown a mind. I am brave, I am bruised, I am who I'm meant to be. This is me. Look out, cause here I come. And I'm marching on to the beat I drum. I'm not scared to be seen, I make no apologies. This is me.
I'm back. I took a week off and then I freaked it. We are here. I was glad to have a little bit of a break. Thank you to Joe for holding it down last week. And we are back in exuberant fashion. And if you listened and you took in the song that we opened with, which is This Is Me from the Greatest Showman soundtrack, you too should be exuberant right now. This week we are talking soundtracks. Golden age for soundtracks, maybe. Tough to say. Is a soundtrack just merch? Who even knows anymore? Before we get too deep into soundtracks, I want to say this is a two-part podcast. The first half will be devoted to soundtracks, and the second half will be devoted to your favorite Patriot and mine, Fergie, and her NBA All-Star Game national anthem a few days ago. But there are three big soundtracks that have come out in the last couple months that have gotten a lot of attention. One is The Greatest Showman. Another is Black Panther, and a third is the third part of the 50 Shades trilogy, 50 Shades Freed. Soundtracks have been, at various points in pop music, in the music business, real moneymakers, and they've kind of come and gone, but they seem to be coming back into vogue, perhaps because they're playlist-esque, who knows. But to talk about soundtracks, I brought in America's foremost soundtrack expert on the phone. That's Rob Harvilla from The Ringer.
Hello.
And chief pop music critic, New York Times. That's John Pareles, not on the phone, sitting right across the table from
me. Live and in concert.
So this has been an interesting month because I think it's probably the only month, and I want to say I should have been a part of this because I feel a little excluded, but y'all both wrote a lot about soundtrack music, and that doesn't happen very often. Is that correct?
True.
So tell me, what's the specificity of the cultural moment that's causing this, JP?
Oh, you're asking tough questions.
Yes.
Well, part of it is, I mean, Black Panther was going to have to be written about regardless. Black Panther is a cultural watershed.
Yes.
And everybody's taking it seriously. 50 Shades is, thank God it's over, end of the trilogy.
But also has had a lot of hits.
Yeah, no, they've done good A&R in the past, so people were anticipating it.
I think 50 Shades core is the original Spotify core. Just learn that. Just throwing that out as an idea.
And the Greatest Showman is, you know, pure uplift. How can you cynics have anything bad to say about it?
You damn right. So, okay. I don't want to bury the lead. So I just want to come right out. I just want to come right out and say it.
Do it.
I enjoyed a lot the Greatest Showman soundtrack.
That's fantastic.
I listened to it this morning for the first time. I had not previously mentally downloaded it, or I have not seen the movie.
You weren't studying it carefully?
I wasn't. And this is, I will go so far as to say, I liked it enough that it made me wonder if I should be seeing the movie. Rob, what do you think?
Well, I enjoyed both the soundtrack and the movie, but I am going to enjoy you enjoying it much more.
That's what I'm here for. So, Rob, explain what the sound, the maximalist pop sound of this soundtrack. Talk about it.
Well, you said it's basically show tunes co-opting Spotify core.
Yes.
Or Spotify core co-opting show tunes. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, The Greatest Showman is the second movie I ever watched with MoviePass, which seems
important.
Like the platonic ideal of a movie that's quote-unquote free. And I became sort of fascinated by it.
But wait, can you not skip the important part? What was the first movie you saw with MoviePass?
Proud Mary, which was not as good. Not as good a movie, not as good a soundtrack.
Oh, my God. Proud Mary. But that is a good MoviePass movie.
Maybe that's the platonic ideal. But The Greatest Showman was much better, both as a sonic and a visual experience.
Okay, so talk about The Greatest Showman. Talk us through the plot for people who have not seen it. The plot in so much as it is a narratively driven film.
It is a P.T. Barnum biopic that sort of posits that what P.T. Barnum was doing when he formed the circus was not like exploiting like the quote-unquote freaks of society, but he was bringing them together and giving them a place where they could truly be themselves and express themselves and express the enormous amounts of sort of triumph and uplift that they had in themselves, but they didn't even know they had it until P.T. Barnum showed them that they had it. And so the movie is like P.T. Barnum is like a poor kid, and he's wooing his rich girlfriend, who's now his wife, and he's down on his luck, and he wants to give his family like everything that they deserve, and so he starts the circus, and he goes around and he finds all the quote unquote freaks of society, and he gets a performance space, and it's the ragtag group of outcasts that
it's bad news. It's bad news bears.
Pretty much, yeah. It's like a billion other movies.
So, but also, and this is Ringling Brothers, just in case people don't know.
That's correct.
What this becomes is the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus.
The circus.
That's right.
As if you were a kid growing up in the 70s in New York, like me, the circus.
Not to spoil the movie, like at the end of the movie, they're like, "What? Have you ever thought of using a tent?" And like, that's the big, like, sort of funny laugh. Yeah. So yes, it is the birth of the circus. And specifically proposing that the circus was woke.
Was this?
Like this was a woke project.
Was this film secretly funded by the Carney lobby?
I have no response to that question. I'm sorry. It's funded by Hugh Jackman. It's like Hugh Jackman's years long passion project. Seriously, not a joke.
No, I know. That's why it's funny.
Exactly.
And just to clarify, I haven't seen it. It doesn't end with him chanting "One of us, one of us."
Oh my gosh! Yeah, that's maybe that was an end credit scene that I didn't.
Right, that was after the credits.
Always a possibility. Yeah.
So this soundtrack's pretty lit, actually.
It's extremely lit.
Okay, so a thing that I was struck by is how effectively it deploys the tricks of contemporary top 40 pop, but uses the lyrics of old-timey lyrics, but like it's sort of not a problem.
One more thing, they're Broadway voices.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
It's probably worth talking about who did the music, who's behind this. And that's Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, who are the La La Land guys. Is that correct?
And the Dear Evan Hansen guys. Like these are like guaranteed EGOT guys.
Yes.
Like this is the royalty. This is show tunes royalty.
And they also, they seem to have a pretty firm grip. Now, and this is something that made me think a lot about Hamilton.
Yeah.
Hamilton, obviously, sort of far superior. But what this thing did in a way that is similarly effective to the Hamilton music and soundtrack is really take slight shades and accents of contemporary pop and deploy them to kind of mask the cheesy thing they're really doing, which is telling the story of P.T. Barnum. Let's listen to the first song on the soundtrack, which is called The Greatest Show.
Ladies and gents, this is the moment you've waited for. You've been searching in the dark, your sweat soaking through the floor. And buried in your bones, there's an ache that you can't ignore. Taking your breath,
stealing your mind, and all that was real is left behind. Don't fight it, it's coming for you, running at you. It's only this moment, don't care what comes after. Your fever dream, can't you see you getting closer? Just surrender, cause you feel the feeling taking over. It's fire, it's freedom, it's flooding open. It's a picture in the pulpit and your blind devotion. There's something breaking at the brick of every wall, it's holding all that you know. So tell me, do you want?
What you hear in that is a tremendous level of exuberance, a sort of more detailed lyric writing than maybe I'm totally comfortable with, but you also hear enough triggers to make you comfortable if you're arriving at this from a radio perspective as opposed to arriving at it from a film perspective. And right. This song, if I'm not mistaken, one of the producers or the additional producers and writers is Ryan Lewis of Macklemore and Ryan Lewis fame. Him and also Ricky Reed, who's also a well-known pop producer. Ricky Reed's got a credit later in the soundtrack. But I think it's interesting that they chose these pop-oriented producer writers for whom exuberance and slight cheese is kind of their métier, and then brought them into the world of kind of high-energy show tunes.
I got from this a big retro vibe, too. You know, it's Queen stomping away.
Ooh.
It's Meatloaf. I get the same feeling from this I get from a Disney soundtrack.
Yes.
Which is like, it's an album parents can give their children because it has such an uplifting message.
And that's why I sort of open with a Corbin Blue joke, because it also reminded me not just of Disney, but Disney Channel movies. Like, specifically, like, I thought a lot about High School Musical when I was listening to this. I feel like the builds, the kind of saccharineness and the builds on a lot of these songs reminded me of that kind of, I guess it was Rock Mafia era. I don't know if it was specifically Rock Mafia, but that era of Disney Channel soundtracks that were incredibly effective and worked as music, not just as soundtracks, but worked independently as music. Shout to This Is Me. I see you.
Shout to Zac Efron.
Zac Efron, out here, he's kind of killing it on this, to be
honest.
Absolutely.
What's your jam off this soundtrack? What's the key cut on the soundtrack?
Well, to me, let's talk about the fake Fall Out Boy record, shall we? That's called The Other Side, with Hugh Jackman and Zac Efron in that hot duet action.
Well, it's intriguing, but to go would cost me greatly. So what percentage of the show would I be taking? Well, fair enough, you'd want a piece of all the action. I'd give you 7, we could shake and make it happen. I wasn't born this morning, 18 would be just fine. Why not just go ahead and ask for nickels on the dime? 15, I'd do 8, 12, maybe 9.
So, like, when I heard this song, I literally was like, your Fall Out Boy could never. Because if you think of Fall Out Boy in its current incarnation, this is the kind of song they would be desperate to put out, and they would never land on it. But I think that somehow this team of people channeled something fundamental about the era of, like, good Fall Out Boy and imported it into this world.
Would it be helpful if I told you the plot point that specifically corresponds to The Other Side?
It might, yeah, like, sure.
What's happening in the movie at that point is that Zac Efron
is going from its second to third wave.
Even weirder is that Zac Efron is a highly respected playwright, is like a theater god who is just sort of bored and stuffy and getting a little pretentious.
He's Arthur Miller.
Sure. And Hugh Jackman is coming to him with the proposition that Zach join the circus, that he join up with this very sort of lowbrow, you know, ragtag group of outcasts and produce like this new kind of uplifting theater. And this is that the other side is Hugh at a bar. Like they're both just sitting at a bar and like the bartender is pouring them drinks and like they dance in the bar and like there's sort of a rhythmic aspect in the movie that's actually kind of cool that's not really in the soundtrack. You need to see this movie is what I'm telling you.
I'm definitely, you have not said one single thing that makes me not want to see this movie. So these are by and large Broadway trained singers. And often what happens when Broadway trained singers approach something that's pop is that somehow it's fragile. There's a fragility in a way. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the production choices on this record, because I was surprised with how kind of thick and lustrous the production was. Rob, since you've seen the movie, is that in your mind a good oral compliment to what's happening visually on the screen?
Yeah, I mean, I think the movie takes place in the 1903, like in 19th century New York, when P.T. Barnum was starting. And so, like, it's obviously, like, really anachronistic. Like, within, like, 5 minutes, you've heard Muse, you've heard One Republic, you've heard Imagine Dragons, especially. You've heard Arcade Fire, you've heard Fallout Boy, and you've heard Fight Song. Like, the big hit off this record, and the one it won the Golden Globe for Best Song, and, like, Dollars to Donuts will probably win the Oscar for Best Song, is This Is Me. And This Is Me is just Fight Song, like just very blatantly and very effectively. Like it's This Is Me, you know, it's supposed to evoke This Is Us and Fight Song simultaneously. And it does that very, very, very well. And so the sort of anachronistic aspect of it that it obviously is ripping off or just paying homage to the pop songs that it's sort of displacing on the Billboard charts right now, like it works okay in the film. Like, my favorite song on this soundtrack is the extremely fake Adele song, Never Enough, which is, I can't remember her last name, but it's the woman, Rebecca, she's in the Mission Impossible movie.
Lauren, well, the singer is Lauren Allred.
Right, exactly. Like, I didn't understand at the time that she was lip syncing, but
Bollywood.
She was a voice. She was a voice contestant, Lauren Allred. Do I have that right?
Like, I believe that is accurate.
I think, yeah. And so, like, it's an Adele song. Like, it's just very, very.
Yeah, let's listen to a little Never Enough by Lauren Allred coming out of the mouth of Rebecca Ferguson.
All the shine of a thousand spotlights, all the stars we steal from the night sky will never be enough.
So this soundtrack is of songs that appear in this movie. You have a movie musical, you have a soundtrack of songs, and that is one way to approach a soundtrack. But in the current sort of soundtrack boom, you have other approaches. And the Black Panther soundtrack is one that takes a different approach, which is music that's in the film, but also quite a bit of music that's inspired by the film. Let's listen to a song that's in the film, which is Pray For Me, which is a Weekend song with Kendrick Lamar.
I'm always ready for a war again. Go down that road again. It's all the same. I'm always ready to take a life again. You know I'll ride again. It's all the same. Tell me who's gonna save me from myself when this life is all I know. Tell me who's gonna save me from this hell. Without you, I'm wild alone.
fight the world, I fight you, I fight myself. I fight God, just tell me how many burdens left. I fight pain and hurricanes, today I wept. I'm trying to fight back tears, flood on my doorsteps. Life and living hell, puddles of blood in the street, shooters on top of
so the thing I learned from watching Black Panther is that if you go into a mildly sleazy club anywhere on the planet, from Brooklyn to Busan, South Korea, The Weeknd will be playing. That is definitely a thing that is notable. Not many of the songs on the Black Panther soundtrack are actually in the film, but the Weeknd song soundtracks a scene where everybody from Wakanda, Chadwick Boseman, Lupita Nyong'o, and the whole crew go to South Korea to get their vibranium back, and they walk in, and it's an illicit casino behind a fish market, and your man, Abel, is out there singing. And I appreciated the specificity of it. It had like kind of a David Simon use of music quality, which is we only hear the music that people are actually playing. So I appreciated that. But that's not the approach taken in the soundtrack. The Black Panther soundtrack features Kendrick Lamar, is organized by Kendrick Lamar and TDE, and has a whole range of music that is not in the film, but is loosely connected to the film. JP, you talked about this in your review about basically the music that's not in the film sort of alluding to themes that are in the film.
Kendrick sort of did a mind meld with the next Kendrick Lamar album and the Black Panther.
Yeah.
Kendrick plays both the Black Panther and Eric Killmonger in various songs.
My only really disappointment about this movie is that more of the soundtrack wasn't in it. It wasn't as much, wasn't nearly as much as I was expecting.
Well, no, that's why I think it's really a Kendrick Lamar album, you know, using somebody else's capital and a lot of somebody else's promotion. Because a lot of the songs, when you get down to it, are about gang warfare in California. And they're about, you know, owning fancy cars and being tough. And also some serious social commentary going on.
Yeah, they're about the universality of those themes. And actually, you know, that's sort of something that I thought the film was really effective at, which is basically doing this kind of hypertrophied sci-fi story about an advanced civilization, but also placing it in the context of kind of the contemporary global Black struggle. And so the soundtrack kind of walks on both sides of that line as well. I'd like to listen actually to the song with Vince Staples and a South African rapper named Eugen Blackrock. That song is called Opts.
I move like a millipede when I flex them tendons like rubber trees. Young Billy Jackson back to the mouthpiece drawn, got a verbal armory. Stack bodies, not figurines. Move beneath the surface, submarine. I'm half machine, obscene with a light sword. Look inside the brain, it's a riot in the psych ward. What you standing on the side for? Roar like a lioness, punch like a cyborg. Spit slick, attack is subliminal. Flowers on my mind, but the rhyme style's sinister. Stab behind my own bars like a seasoned criminal. Gotham City streets are playing the crushing any system that belittles us. Antidote to every poison they administer. Switching like time signatures. Colors in my aura tend to cover the perimeter. Brown bodies that the blues wanna shoot through. High res lenses wanna over your eyes. My strength ain't nothing like my size. Blades on the top, Kathleen Cleaver. Tangle my cords like a weaver.
Tune them.
Ops on the radar.
You're dead to me.
How you wanna play ball?
You're dead to me.
Takes off.
You're dead to me. You're dead to me. You're dead to me.
You know what zone I'm in.
You're dead to me.
Don't care who you with.
You're dead to me.
Watch me do my.
You're dead to me. You're dead to me.
Tune them.
So this is a great song. And
this is seriously good.
This is a really great song. And JP, I think you guys both wrote about the soundtrack. JP, I think you specifically talked about how the South African rapper really kind of eats everybody else for lunch.
He does.
On this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, really impressive.
Eugen Blackrock, the South African rapper, for one thing, is a woman. She's got the best vocabulary. She's got the craziest free associations. She's as complex as the others. And with a better flow, and they give her the space to do it too, which is great. I mean, I think that it's a good thing that she's getting this springboard.
And this is also one of a couple songs on the soundtrack that explicitly reference contemporary African music of any kind. There's South African house music. There's Gom, which is a sort of recently emergent scene over the last two or three years. Let's listen to the song that kind of best encapsulates that sound, and that is Redemption, which is by Zakari with Babes Wodumo.
Party all of our lives away.
So at the Red Bull Music Academy last year, there was a Gom night in Williamsburg or Greenpoint, I can't remember. And it was my first time hearing it in a nightclub setting, not hearing it coming through the internet. Very physically intense. The texture of the drums was really, really very, very, it was much more alive than most of contemporary American dance music.
Wow.
It wasn't a lot of subtlety to it. It was interesting to watch people dance to it, because I feel like there were people who were incredibly in the moment and kind of like taking it and feeding off of it. And then there were some people I saw kind of walking back and forth because they could only handle it in doses.
Wow.
Yeah, it was one of the more, it reminded me a little bit of seeing Godspeed You Black Emperor the first time, where I like couldn't stay in the room the whole time because the textures were actually so intense. That sort of, I saw people going in and out of the main room a bunch, dancing for 10 minutes and then just being like, you can almost see them physically exhaling and then walking out. So that's something that this album does. It sort of goes back and forth between America and Africa, obviously, in the same way that the film goes back and forth. The score, maybe a little bit less so. The score is not on this album, but
There's an instrumental score by Ludwig Göransson.
Right, exactly.
Who's Ryan Coogler's go-to guy for movie music. But Göransson did, I don't know, he spent 3 weeks going around Africa with Baba Mal from Senegal, and he immersed himself in an archive of African recordings. And he uses a lot of talking drums and kora and African sounds, but it's still in the context of whip 'em up action movie music.
So to that point, I would say that this movie, both in the film and also the music, made me as anxious as almost any movie I've seen as an adult. I thought the music was used pretty effectively. I don't sort of say something like edge of the seat lightly. It's trite and cliche. But I did find myself like quite uneasy at many points throughout the film. Some of that had to do with the pace of the filmmaking and the visuals. And some of that had to do with the use of music and the score. So to that point, I think
Göransson did
a good job.
Yeah, no, he studied a lot of the African drumming. And, you know, he said in I think it was a Pitchfork interview that, you know, he wanted to incorporate the drums you would hear to drive people into war at a point when people are going to war.
It was very nerve-wracking, I thought. Rob, what did you think?
It was super, super intense. And like the stakes were immediately higher than in any previous Marvel movie. Like, if you see a lot of these Marvel movies, the knock against them is that there's no consequence to anything. That they're plotted out so far ahead that you know all these people are going to be around. Like, nobody's going to die. Like, nothing too bad is going to happen. And I thought that one of the really effective things about this movie was that it didn't try and connect to the larger Marvel universe at all. And that allowed it to have like a much higher, just much higher emotional stakes, and just a greater degree of intensity that I think the music, both the score and the Kendrick parts of it, really fueled. Like, there's a sense of anxiety and just sort of unease and just a sense that anything can happen, which is very much not the vibe of most comic books. Movies right now, the vibe is like only a very specific number of things can happen because we need to make like 50 more of these in the next 3 years. Like, I think being more of a hermetically sealed kind of story, I think really was a big help to this movie in every way.
And also the idea that this movie exists in this current social and political context, and also at the same time that Kendrick Lamar is a force in contemporary popular music. Like, that is all of a feather. Let's listen to the title song. Let's listen to Kendrick's Black Panther, which is short, but potent.
Wait.
My city, king of my country, king of my homeland, king of the filthy, king of the fallen, we living again, king of the shooters, looters, boosters, and ghettos popping, king of the past, present, future, my ancestors watching, king of the culture, king of the soldiers, king of the bloodshed, king of the wisdom, king of the ocean, king of the respect, king of the optimistic and dreamers that go and get it, king of the winners, district and geniuses with conviction, king of the fighters, king of the fathers, king of the belated, king of the answer, king of the problem, king of the forsaken, king of the empathy and resentment, king of remorse, king of my enemies.
The sort of hit, quote unquote, from the soundtrack is the SZA and Kendrick song, which is All the Stars. But to me, the first song, which is Black Panther, is a much more effective both evocation of what's actually happening in the film, but also as a better Kendrick performance.
Well, it's also much more experimental. The track is crazy.
It's my that's my preferred Kendrick, like the stranger, more experimental.
Yeah.
You know, like To Pimp a Butterfly over Damn for me.
Yeah, I join you in that.
Yeah.
The soundtrack does its minimum as merch, which is to have the Kendrick and SZA song and to have the Kendrick and the Weeknd song. Those are the two movie-themed songs. Yes. And then Kendrick Lamar and his friends and acquaintances and discoveries just go off on their own crazy journey, which is wonderful.
Speaking of soundtrack as merch, this is a good opportunity to transition to the third soundtrack that we're going to talk about, which is from 50 Shades Freed, which I know all of our dedicated listeners know is the third part of the 50 Shades trilogy. You mentioned The Weeknd, who obviously had a big hit with Earned It from the last or the first? Who even knows?
First.
Yeah. Thank you. Shouts to Rob and shouts to your wife, Nicole. Getting that romance money. Can we talk about Nicole's romance writing?
Well, in an extremely anonymous type way. Like, so my wife writes romance novels, but both like the genres and the pen name she prefers to keep, you know, anonymous for her own nefarious reasons. But I mean, she was telling me about 50 Shades back when it was Twilight fan fiction, when it was entirely like an online phenomenon. And like, we've seen the movies since then, but like, we were way early on the 50 Shades.
Back when it was just 20 Shades?
Yeah, just the first shade, the earliest shade.
Wasn't Earned It the moment where we realized The Weeknd would be a pop star?
Yes.
Where he went from like the internet, like think piece generator to like actual pop star. And he was sort of exactly scuzzy and dangerous enough to like be in a spot like that, but like not send your mom running out of the theater in terror.
The thing that I think is very striking about Earned It at that moment in The Weeknd's career, and I think this sort of speaks to one of the utilities of soundtracks, it kind of allowed him access, direct access, to a completely different audience and idea without fundamentally undercutting what was at his essence. Now, he may have evolved his essence over the course of the albums that came out around that same time period, but Earned It was such a strange left field turn at the moment. And it was so strange, but he was so powerful that not only did it become a big pop record, but it weirdly like reverse crossed over, it crossed back over to like Hot 97. Which is not a radio station that would ever play like a kind of portentous Stefan Macchio ballad. And yet he pulled it off.
I feel like this third soundtrack for 50 Shades Freed like could potentially do the same thing for Julia Michaels.
Ooh.
Who I really like a lot and who I think is sort of the 50 Shades like universe, like sounds like made into like a human being. Like, you know, like I'm really sexy. I'm really sexy, but I'm unhappy about it. Like, I feel like her whole vibe is sort of based on the sort of sound that these soundtracks have sort of trafficked.
Should we play Heaven from Julia Michaels on this soundtrack?
Absolutely, we should.
Let's do that.
Love's more. Sacred, so hard to replace. Falling for him was like falling from grace. All wrapped in one, he was so many sins. Would have done anything, everything for him. And if you asked me, I would do it again. No need to imagine, cause I know it's true. They say,
craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. I developed this recipe when I was down in Georgia with my family. It stars a Korean red pepper powder called gochugaru. I love the way it blooms in the maple syrup and the rice vinegar. If you don't have gochugaru, you should totally get some. It's super versatile. It's not just that it brings heat, but fruity sweetness as well. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Not only is that ambivalence in Julia Michaels sort of right for this movie and this character, but Julia Michaels is someone who I think writes to a theme really well because she's been a professional songwriter long before she was an ascendant pop star. So I think this is, as we say, light work for her to make songs like this, even if it is also like kind of on brand.
Yeah, and like the legacy of these movies is going to be the trailers. Like the trailers is the apex of that thing where every trailer has to have like a really slow, moody, portentous version of like an existing pop song.
Yep.
You know, like the way that it was Crazy in Love, right? The first one was somebody doing Beyonce's Crazy in Love in like a very, very slow sort of agonized fashion, you know? And like, as far as 50 Shades Freed, like, I don't think the world needed like that version of Never Tear Us Apart by NXS. You know, it's like, it's sort of, this is like way goopier in both the sonic sense and like the Gwyneth Paltrow sense.
We should listen to that. Is that actually on the soundtrack? I actually don't know if that's on. Is it?
It is.
Maybe not on my Spotify.
What's there?
All right.
Never Tear Us Apart, sung by the inimitable Bishop Briggs.
That's right.
Fine. Let's just listen to it.
Don't ask me what you know is true. Don't have to tell you. Oh, I love your precious heart.
Come on, that's dark. Think how dark that is.
Okay.
I mean, the lights dimmed in our studio as that song was playing.
Fine. Just because we listen to that, I'm not going to subject anybody to the Jamie Dornan song on this sound.
No, that's grim. But I got to give a shout out to Jesse J, who does James Brown.
You're definitely the only person who said that sentence in the calendar year of our Lord 2018.
Who does a James Brown song? I Feel Good. I got you. Who does that song as a slow, agonized 50 Shades soundtrack song? I mean, that's a little ballsy.
Is that what soundtrack do I have? I don't even have that.
You don't
on my
have
soundtrack.
That.
Maybe. First of all, the soundtrack is 22 tracks long. Like, it's enormous. And yeah, I listened to it today, and that blew right by me that it was a James Brown cover.
It's know? There it is.
It's going so on brand for 50 Shades that it completely destroys the James Brown song.
So it's a credit. To itself is what you're saying.
It's high concept.
Also, there's a fake Weekend song. It's like, if you can't get the real Weekend anymore, you have a fake Weekend song, which is the Black Atlas song. It's called Sacrifice.
Also slow, agonized, and blasphemous.
Yes. Let's listen to a little bit of Black Atlas, Sacrifice, featuring Jesse Reyes, who I like a lot.
Sacrifice my love, not even for you. You know I don't play safe. Sometimes you have to break the rules. Yeah, we could call it love, or we could call it nothing. But you got what I want. Call it nothing, but you got what I want. You know I do too. So let me let you just lay me down. Turn me on.
Okay, so if the Greatest Showman soundtrack functions as sort of like a real representation of a film, and if the Black Panther soundtrack serves as kind of an abstract analogous companion piece to the film, I feel like the 50 Shades soundtracks do something that's slightly different, which is they capture the kind of vapor of an essence of a thing and then go and kind of try to have that embodied elsewhere. And well, then it cycles back into the movie.
Well, you don't just think that, like, in case I didn't film this scene effectively enough, the song tells you what it's about.
Well, that too.
I have the feeling that that's what the function of these songs is. Here's what you just saw. Here's what you're about to see.
The thing I was thinking about soundtracks is, do they make more sense in the playlist era? Not to say that soundtracks have never been successful. Obviously, you have the great hip-hop film soundtracks of the 90s. You have the blaxploitation soundtracks of the 70s. There's obviously
Saturday Night Fever, Urban Cowboy.
Sure. So there have been plenty of moments. But is there something specific to putting out an album that's a little bit around the organizing principle is not one single artist? Does it make more sense, and therefore are people trained to hear it in a different way in the playlist era?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Thanks for playing. I mean, what am I supposed to say?
Can't argue with you.
Okay,
no,
fine.
No, seriously. I mean, it's hip hop is also decentered the one artist thing.
Oh, of course.
With like a zillion posse cuts. So
right, and we were going that DJ way anyway. Albums. Yeah. But it's something that I feel when I, especially on the 50 Shades soundtrack, I was just like, oh, this, if Spotify had just put this up as a, you know, new sweaty music playlist, like I wouldn't have blinked at it.
Yeah.
I thought it was fine.
Looking at this track list, these are all people who are trying to be big pop stars and have not quite succeeded. Like, isn't there a subplot in these movies that Rita Ora's character is always in danger and nobody cares? Like, they're like, oh, no, Rita Ora got kidnapped, and like, oh, that's terrible, sex scene, you know? And, oh, we found Rita Ora, she's fine. Like, oh, that's great, like, sex scene. Like, she's in these movies, but she's not actually in these movies. And she just gets to be on a pop soundtrack, you know, with, like, Liam Payne and Hailee Steinfeld and, like, all these people who are trying to be A-listers and can't quite make it.
And
the
OG of that approach, Ellie Goulding.
There we go.
Who's back on the soundtrack.
So, yeah, she sneaks in right at the end there. You're right. Right after Maybe I'm Amazed.
They're all hoping to be the new Weekend. Basically, yeah. They're all hoping to get that this soundtrack is their springboard into megastardom.
Okay, well, to close this portion of the podcast, maybe we should just listen to The Real Weekend and Earned It.
Like it's magic, oh, yeah. 'Cause I see nobody but you. I'm never confused. Hey, and I'm so used to being used. So I love when you're all unexpected. 'Cause I hate when the moment's expected.
Okay, now that y'all have been duly soothed by Able Testify, let me take you in another direction. I want you to get relaxed. I want you to open your ears. And I want you to open your mind to the unusual stylings of Fergie.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly wave at the twilight's last gleaming? Whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming.
As you know, Fergie had a monumental week. She sang the national anthem, which you just heard, oh, but a piece of, but I highly recommend you go hear the whole thing. She sung the national anthem at the NBA All-Star Game, and it was the source of many memes, much derision, great facial reactions from Draymond Green. Fergie, as you can tell, delivered the national anthem in a style that didn't bear a tremendous amount of similarity to the national anthem we generally know. She sang it the way I tried to explain it to someone was if she was trying to seduce a very naughty flag.
Wow. Wow.
And for this, she was derided. She was drawn and quartered and taken and tarred and feathered and dragged across Twitter. And I say, no, it is time to redeem Fergie. I want to also shout out a podcast listener. I got an email at the podcast email this week. And I've been thinking a lot about Fergie's national anthem. I texted Karen about it. And I was like, you know, this really wasn't that bad. I feel like if I was in the conversation when it happened, I feel like we could have like set it right a little bit. But I didn't. And then I got an email from a gentleman, podcast listener named Christopher Spade. Hey, Chris. Subject heading, you already know, parentheses, what this email's about.
Always a good sign.
Oh, and you know Rob Harville stuck around. I didn't even say who joined us. No, Joe Cascarelli and Karen Gans are here.
They've been quietly laughing.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Joe Cascarelli and Karen Gans are here because everyone has to come and weigh in
for
on
the
Fergie.
Special second part of this
is actually no cap to the first part. And no smoke to Rob Harville and John Perales, who are also still here. But like this
unbelievably.
Yes. Thank you, JP. But this is the most important part of this week's podcast. Anyway, so Chris Pabe, dear everyone at the podcast, that involves everyone at this table and also Rob.
And a cast of thousands of guests.
That's true.
Welcome to the tribe, Rob.
It's an honor.
Long time, first time. How will John Caramonica defend Fergie's national anthem? I'll take my answer on air. Looking forward to it.
Well, because this is important context for people who haven't heard you defend Fergie on previous podcasts.
That's true. Fergie put out an album last year with a bunch of low-key bangers on it.
Called Double Duchess. It was a double album.
A video
album.
A visual album. Yes. Sorry, I did not see the visuals.
Still.
Joe and I did. They're good. Yeah.
Okay, so the y'all can vouch for the visuals. I vouch for the audios. So anyway. Fergie is someone who I think is criminally misunderstood in our contemporary pop ecosystem. And I saw the national anthem performance a few hours after it happened, and I will not stand for the slander. I will not.
Rob, you wrote some of that slander.
I did write some of that slander. I spent all day not watching that just because
nobody asked your opinion.
Hey.
Except Sean Fennessy, his editor.
Yeah. And Amanda Dobbins. Yes. Rob, like fine. Say what you need to
you,
say.
You had a fire God. Line in there, Rob.
You're going to have to be more specific, Karen.
I'm going to pull it up right now.
Okay, Karen is going to do a dramatic reading of Rob Harbilla's fire about Fergie.
Well,
and then I'm going to come back with even more fire.
Oh, my God. This is
the line I liked so much, Rob, was, Everything Fergie does designed to send you on a whiplash journey from oh no to oh wow to oh fine. Good line.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Karen. I did spend all day not watching that. I was like, I can't watch videos of people screwing up on Wheel of Fortune. Mm-hmm. You know, and like one of those go like somebody can't spell potato or something and they lose like $5,000. Like, I immediately put this anthem in the same category and I was like, I was refusing to watch it until my editors at The Ringer very politely asked me to watch it and sort of
release the emails.
Discourse.
Release the slacks.
Upon it. It was not as bad as I thought it was going to be.
I was going
to
ask you, did you think it was truly bad? Because that's the thing. I'm here to say leave Fergie alone as well.
We're all here.
Right.
Team
so,
Fergie.
John, the question I'll
ask
you.
I'm not sure
you.
I'm here to say leave Fergie.
JP will be exiting the podcast.
This is where you throw your headphones down and stop out.
For Caramonica, like, do you think that this performance, I know you don't think this performance was bad, but what is it about Fergie that even her minor infractions turn into ridicule so many years?
I'm so glad you asked, Joe. Thank you. I would love to address this pressing question. Fergie's been a performer since she was a child. You know, shouts to Kids Incorporated. She's been out here doing it, moving her face in expressive
fashion. Stacey Ferguson.
Yes, moving her face in expressive fashion for a really long time. Fergie has no chill. And Fergie also has no aesthetic center. So when someone silly putties her in one direction, a la Black Eyed Peas, she's capable of doing that. When she, hosts The Four and kind of breaks into impromptu song, she's okay at that. I think Fergie's number one goal in any circumstance, television, music, national anthem, is to be seen. And so she chose a rendition that was a little bluesy, a little fake jazzy. Shouts to all my jazz listeners who are going to press delete on this podcast.
Hashtag jazz.
Yeah, hashtag jazz. And that was all performance. Now, JP, I emailed JP and I said, look, man, I'm just a pop music critic, right? I just like records and I write about them. JP has perfect pitch. So I was like, hey, can you listen to this and tell me how bad it is? JP, speak on it.
I said, well, she's flat.
Yeah.
The diction on the, shall we say, lyrics.
Or if Fergie were to say that word. Yeah.
We should all be forced to sing the national anthem before we get out of here.
It's a little strange, I have to admit.
So to that point, I also spoke today with someone who has some thoughts on Fergie's relationship to correct notation. Here's a little conversation I had with Nick Perez. Nick is a freelance musician in the Bay Area. He's completing a degree, an undergraduate degree in music at St. Mary's College. I found him when I was emailing with JP about Fergie's relationship to pitch, and JP found a notation, a vocal transcription, that was done by Nick. And Nick's here on the phone to call in and talk to us about it. Hey, man, what's up? How you doing?
I'm doing good, John. How about you?
I'm great. So I was pretty surprised to see this, and as I was talking about earlier in the podcast, I am not traditionally trained in music theory, although I can read music from when I was a wee lass. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to the Fergie National Anthem and why you chose to try to notate it?
Well, the real truth about it is it was kind of out of boredom.
That's great.
I was in New York on a short trip, and I couldn't sleep. And so I was surfing through Facebook, and I found one of my friends on Facebook had shared a video of the national anthem saying that it was just absolutely horrible. And so I listened to it for myself, and it was definitely an interesting interpretation of it.
You don't have to be kind.
Yeah, it was, she made some choices.
Yes.
And I was actually inspired to do this by a video that had been circulating around previously on the internet. A pianist somewhere here in the States had heard a rendition of the national anthem at a Trump rally in Oregon. And the singer in this video was just all over the place. Really, I mean, she made, this singer in this video made Fergie sound like Susan Boyle. It was...
Team Susan Boyle. Yeah, we approve. We approve of Susan Boyle on the podcast.
This person had accompanied this Trump rally singer in a side-by-side video on the piano. And it was hilarious. And so since I was in a hotel room in New York, I didn't have a piano with me. So I just notated it.
So this notation was obviously also full of jokes. So can you talk a little bit about the kind of the contrast between the seriousness of the notation, but also some of the humorous asides in it?
Let's see. I think at the beginning of the piece, I wrote Tempo di Fergie.
Yes.
So it's part of it is the serious classical Italian notation combined with, you know, things that aren't Italian, aren't part of the classical genre. So Tempo di Fergie, I wrote pitch optional.
True.
Just because that is what it seemed like she was going for. And then I wrote con vibrato ridicolo. So with ridiculous vibrato, because that's what I heard. To me, it sounded like someone was shaking her the entire performance.
You mean that's not in the operatic tradition, Nick? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Well, I think for what she was going for, it was not the right choice.
So if we were to hear, I know I asked you about how to actually make a comparison between the notations and like a traditional national anthem. So what are the points if we were to actually hear someone who is not Fergie, but singing those notes that you notated, what are the kind of key moments or points that would be points of difference between that and a more traditionally on-pitch version of the anthem? What were the things that jumped out at you that were different?
She was trying to go for kind of this jazzy, bluesy yes. rendition of the anthem. Mm-hmm. And she was doing that, but she was not closing off a lot of the words she was singing. And so the humor in what I transcribed is in the notes themselves, the music, but also in the lyrics, because I did transcribe what I heard for the lyrics.
Yes, like there was a, like the Twilight Laz gleaming.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they're all, and it's funny because we've been talking about it here amongst the pop music staff, and she sings like 60% of a syllable, right? 70% of a syllable, which is strange because you think of a syllable as kind of a immutable unit of a word or of a sound, but she somehow manages to sing 2/3 of them half the time.
Exactly. And so she was, you know, instead of gave proof through the night, I heard gave prue through the night, or through the nigh, I should say.
Yes, prue so, through the nigh. Yes, it's actually right there on your notation. And right above it, right above the triplet figure, is hand gestures discarding pitch.
Yes, because in her performance in the video, she was doing this thing where she was kind of throwing her hand to the side, and I saw that as like a physical interpretation of what she was doing to the note, just kind of throwing them away.
Deep down, do you believe that Fergie knew and made all those choices consciously, or do you think that this is her lacking? This is kind of like the best version of it that she has in her.
Oh no, I definitely don't think it's the best version of it she has in her. I think she was trying to go for a certain vibe. She was trying to go for a certain style, and it didn't quite work out the way she hoped it would. There's no doubt in my mind, at least, that Fergie is a great musician. So, no, I do think that she does have a better rendition of the national anthem in her.
Okay, well, Nick, I appreciate you talking to me about this big Fergie adventure, which could have only happened, as Fergie might say, in the home of the Bray. Thanks so much, man.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
Love.
Fergie sings about 50 to 60% of the syllable. She doesn't finish the syllable in many cases. She sings about
50 to 60%. And there was one bad note. I mean, like, a bad note.
Right. But it wasn't. Bad. Roseanne Barr was out there tweeting, like, how bad it was. And I was like, hey, Ma.
Did she?
I think she did.
She did.
Everybody got involved in this. Which, again, Fergie, punching bag.
Pile on. It was a pile on.
Yes, but then, not to throw back to the podcast of 2 weeks ago, but there is a way that Twitter logic unfolds. Mm-hmm. And I think this was an interesting example that I think if it had not happened in real time, it would have aged or at least been perceived with a little bit more empathy. Because I saw, obviously, 2 hours later, but I saw what had happened on Twitter. And I think it was much easier to be like, oh, make a meme, make a GIF, et cetera, than to say, actually, I don't know that this was that terrible. And I am here to say it was not that terrible. I think it's funny. I think Fergie is a performer. I think she's aware that she embraces her task in a, frankly, a greatest showman kind of way.
Well, it kind of reminded me of the Mariah Carey at New Year's Eve, quote-unquote, debacle, mm-hmm. which was, again, a moment of pile-on where, like, you know, what happened to her, it was embarrassing, but it became amplified because people were looking for something to laugh at. And keep in mind, last weekend was pretty dark. We're coming off of a school shooting. I think people on Twitter were looking for something to talk about other than, you know, the depths of hell that we're living in right now.
Strong media team.
Well, I have, to add to that, an economic take, which is that this is about capitalism. This is about the internet.
I think you mean capitalism.
We're going to go to karaoke right after this.
You're not sliding the pitch enough.
The internet needs content.
Yes.
And this is the most clickable of content.
So trending.
Joe is speaking as we are both have been bloggers. Responsible for blogging.
Yeah. It's like, this is, you know, you see that and it doesn't matter if it's the worst rendition ever. Your headline has to say the worst rendition ever because you need people to click on it.
Right. So let
Plus, you can also become an expert on this in 2 minutes. You know, click it, watch it, take.
Exactly. Speaking of her diction, I just want to read a tweet that is going around a little bit. Pedro, I apologize because you're going to have to bleep me, but it's just a meme that's a little topical. And the tweet says, bruh, I just want to know who was the first person to look up at the stars and say, that shit's spangling.
But can you credit the Twitter user?
It's not printable in our newspaper. But if you Google the word spangling, you'll find this tweet.
Pedro, you can leave all this crosstalk, please.
Sorry, I just thought that it was just
people like to know what our process is like.
Yes, no, I want to be completely fourth wall knocked down. Also, from let's talk about the music just for a sec before we talk about some other analogs to this Fergie national anthem. People make unusual choices with the national anthem more often than you would think. And I think if you took Fergie's national anthem as a genre exercise rather than a sober attempt to deliver the national anthem, I think people in general would be a lot more forgiving of it. Now, if your genre that you're choosing to employ is Jessica Rabbit Core, then I can see why you might take some L's along the way. But again, let's remember, this is Fergie. Y'all are just 2000 and late.
Ooh.
I think it's down to the reaction shots of the players on the court. I think it's such a standard thing, the national anthem. I mean, if it's good, if it's bad, if it's super experimental, if it's traditional, like, there's the shots of the players and their heads are down or they're sort of bobbing and they're just stone-faced and they do not react to anything that happens ever. And the key to this thing was, like, the killer moment for me was, like, the laugh track. Like, right at the end, like, right after Banner Yet Wave, like, she stops and she takes a big breath, and I think that's where Draymond Green shows up. The crowd laughs. Like, there is an actual, like, laugh break in the middle of the national anthem. And I think I agree with Joe completely that this is just sort of a key viral sort of thing that bloggers understood. But what pushed it over the top, I think, was that you get what never happens, and it's the players physically, like, visually reacting to it in real time.
But keep in mind, this is also the All-Star game. This is the clown game of basketball. Right.
Yeah, everyone was in a loose mood. Because I was on a flight to Los Angeles getting ready to watch the All-Star game. Hadn't plugged in my headphones yet because the game hadn't started. You know, a lot of preamble. And as soon as I saw Fergie sort of saunter up to the microphone, mm-hmm. I grabbed my earphone. I was like, something tells me I should watch this. And I was not let down.
Not let down. There are other moments in National Anthem. We've done a previous podcast about the political importance of the National Anthem. But there are other National Anthems that have, say, veered from the norm.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed by the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched was so gallant.
I miss a little bit of the dialogue around the Fergie thing, so I don't know how much this was mentioned, but I did not see it a lot of places. There is a particular version from, I believe, a 2005 boxing match by none other than R. Kelly, who, you know...
Problematic fave caveat.
Caveat, you know...
Wow.
Accused of all sorts of sexual misconduct.
I would just say problematic. We could take fave out of there.
Fine. You can, Pedro, delete that.
But he did a version of the National Anthem that was an early YouTube favorite. I watched it a lot in the year 2006 when I was first getting into playing a lot of viral YouTube videos. But R. Kelly does this version with a beat. It's a Steppers anthem. Mm-hmm. He literally has Chicago Steppers dancing in the boxing ring behind him. And by the time he gets to the end, to the climax, he is ad-libbing the stars out of the Spangled Banner. He gives a couple clap your hands, y'alls, some exclamations mm-hmm. throughout. And it's similar to Rob, what you were describing. You start to see the reaction, like people breaking towards the end, and certain people are sort of grinning and nodding their heads. And then you get a shot of Oscar De La Hoya in a suit. I guess he's probably a promoter for the fight. And he just has like the blankest look on his face, like trying so hard not to break. I highly recommend anyone who's interested in bizarre national anthems, if you can stomach looking at R. Kelly, Give this thing a shot, because it really makes Fergie look, like a Broadway singer, like Adele, like the most straightforward vocalist you could possibly imagine.
And one more potential reference point for the broader conversation about the Fergie National Anthem was brought to our attention by new culture editor of the New York Times, Gilbert Cruz, and also Simpsons fanboy. He came over. Did he email to us?
He emailed it to us. He watched the video with
us. So talk us through.
Karen.
Oh, this is a from the classic era of The Simpsons that everybody over 30 is more familiar with. It's a rendition.
I know. Well, it's hard being 27.
It's tough. Millennial John Caramonica barely knows the reference.
I don't know any of those things.
But there's an episode of The Simpsons where, I believe, is it Bleeding Gums Murphy, mm-hmm. is singing the national anthem before a sporting event. And the clock begins, and he continues, and he continues. And I think we should just listen to a little bit right now.
Oh, oh, oh say, can you, I'm asking, can you see?
Bursting, suited off, popping web in the air.
It's long, ladies and gentlemen. It's long.
I mean, that was the thing with the Fergie one for me. It was the tempo that really threw me.
Yes.
Like, it was just a little bit too slow.
Yes.
But then you couldn't bend all the syllables for as long as you wanted.
I think to me, it's the contrast between the slow, languorous tempo and the cut short with certain words, the tension between those two things, and also her facial expressions. I'm sorry, but like, I'm definitely the only person.
That you're defending her. Now you're just turning on her.
No. Yeah. But here's the thing.
I'm defending this.
I'm definitely the only person at this table that watched The Four. Right?
That's true. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So The Four, as you guys probably do not know, was a competition show a la American Idol or The Voice that has recently been airing. And Fergie was the host. And clearly she went to some, I don't know if it's her natural thing or she went to some kind of hosting class, because she is not a Cat Deely. She is,
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, good reference, yeah. Right? No, she's not a Cat Deely figure. Like, she's definitely, I don't know, it's very vaudeville. It's very Greatest Showman. And so that is something that she's employing in her day-to-day career. And frankly, I applaud that she brought it to a national anthem that breathed life into a tired locale.
Prediction. Next year, this week, perhaps on Vulture, we will read the oral history of Fergie's NBA All-Star Game National Anthem 2018.
Let's just get out in front and just do it.
We'll just do it ourselves.
Like, just do it next week.
And Draymond will be the star, yeah. Obviously.
Yes, that's really what you need to do.
But you know, the larger point is that the National Anthem is a career killer. Or it should be. It's like, why do people volunteer for this? I mean, Pink, who's got leather lungs and great pitch, not so good at the Super Bowl.
She was ill.
It was a throat lozenge.
That's
not gum.
True.
Not
it was
gum.
A throat lozenge. But I mean, there's so many bad Star Spangled Banners out there. I think Fergie just, in a way, she just joined the crowd.
It's really hard to sing. We've talked about it before, but it's like ridiculously hard to sing. Oh, Canada is much nicer and easier.
Anyway, she's still top 10. So thanks to the whole team for coming in.
Rob says top 10 what?
Thanks to everybody. No, Rob.
Rob, she's on our list.
Aye.
Leave Fergie alone.
Thanks to everybody for the big conversation about Fergie. I appreciate it, and so does Fergie.
What you gonna do with all that junk inside your trunk?
I'ma get you drunk, get you love drunk off my hump. My hump, my hump, my hump, my hump, my hump. My hump, my hump, my hump, my lovely little lumps. Check it out.
And that's our show this week. Thanks to all my guests, Rob Harvilla calling in from Ohio for two parts of the podcast, John Perellis, Karen Gans, Joe Coscarelli, and also calling in from his car, Nick Perez. Listen to every podcast ever, nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, because clearly I take dares, at podcast@nytimes.com. You could subscribe to the podcast, and why wouldn't you with all this fire content? iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get that audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Head Stepper Media, and I will be back next week. They got you. She's got me spending. Oh, spending all your money on me and spending time on me. She's got me spending. Oh, spending all your money on me, on me. What you gonna do with all that junk inside that trunk? I'ma get you drunk, get you love drunk off my hump. What you gonna do with all that ass inside of me?
Save big money at Menards. Keep your lawn looking its best with Menards' premium four-part fertilizer program. Each step is tailor-made for the health of your lawn. Get started this spring with a bag of crabgrass preventer with lawn food. Apply just once early in the spring to feed your lawn for over 2 months. Pick it up in our garden center today and check out Menards.com for more hot deals happening now. Save big money.